Urban life can be treacherous for someone with dementia, from the chaos of traffic to the peril of credit cards to the many opportunities to end up lost at the mercy of strangers. But what if we could change that? Is it possible to make our cities more dementia-friendly? I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're joined now by a sociologist who's trying to answer that question. She'll be speaking at the library this Friday. Emily Kearns, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, what are some of the characteristics of American cities as we've built them that are particularly hard for people with dementia?
Right. Well, the cities themselves, are increasingly technology-centric. So you can think about GPS and apps. And while we have the physical layout of cities, we need to think about the architectural design. So, for example, I'm here at the Marriott. It is not dementia-friendly. I have to take 3 elevators, for example, to find my room. So with anyone with a cognitive disability and memory disability, it's really difficult to navigate, menus in large restaurants, business districts. Parking now, at least in the Boston area, is all by app. And that's really, really difficult for folks with cognitive challenges.
So I am curious, what are the numbers on how many people have dementia? This isn't like a niche concern.
No, this is definitely not a niche concern. In fact, the World Health Organization has just declared it a public health issue because it's impacting every single area of our society. The Alzheimer's Association says 1 out of 10 folks over 60 and 1 out of 3 folks over 80 have some form of dementia. Dementia is an umbrella term. Alzheimer's is the most common. But increasingly, we're finding that there are more types of dementia, and many folks go undiagnosed. So these are actually underestimates. And this is a global concern now. In Japan, for example, in Tokyo, they have professionals walking the streets to identify folks who are disoriented from dementia.
People walking the streets. Can you talk to me about that? Because that seems like, to American ears, like that's not the type of measure that I could imagine in an American city, that we would send people out to stand there looking for people who might be confused.
Yeah, it's actually quite stunning. You can see in the streets, but also in grocery stores, folks who are, not living on the streets, but folks who are standing at intersections, quite hesitant and daunted about crossing. Sometimes they're disoriented in terms of what the signage means. And this is a way that even children can become a dementia aware, can become a dementia friend, which is a national, actually a global movement. They can become aware of someone wanting to cross the street and being a little disoriented. They can be aware of someone in their library who's disoriented, and even children, especially children, can help.
I feel like the impulse among people I know, and I totally appreciate this, is to just, as soon as you realize someone you care about has dementia, try to keep them from being in those situations, like keep them from being out walking by themselves. You were talking about parking. It is, I am a little surprised to hear you talking about that, because it's been like my perception that you try to prevent a person with dementia from driving. No?
Yeah, and this is one of the, I facilitate a care partner or caregiver or coffee hour support group, and this is one of the challenges, major challenges that all families face is when do we encourage someone and to stop driving when it's too dangerous? It's one of the most difficult things in the world, especially in the American culture where we're so dependent on our cars. So folks are driving who shouldn't be driving, who struggle with cognitive challenges. But the notion of a dementia-friendly community is such that folks can live as independently as possible for as long as possible, living the life that they choose with the dignity that they deserve. And so if folks are aware, maybe they shouldn't be driving, but they can be encouraged to drive more safely, within certain limits in the earlier stages. There's someone who bicycles in our area, and now his spouse is looking for a bicycle companion to go with him. So there's a lot of strategies, especially around companionship, and you know, journeying with someone, supporting them with dementia so that they can still go out. Social isolation is a huge issue, not only with dementia, but with other chronic diseases. And again, it's a World Health Organization issue. And the more isolated folks are, the more depressed they are, and the more difficult it is to live, you know, with dignity and independence.
You've worked with a lot of different communities in Massachusetts where you live on dementia friendliness, and you actually have a toolkit. Can you talk about that?
Right. So Dementia Friendly Massachusetts and now Dementia Friendly Kansas City. That's all right. Are part of Dementia Friendly America. So Dementia Friendly America is obviously a national grassroots movement, cross-sector movement that was hatched in Minnesota. Act on Alzheimer's was the original movement, and they developed a toolkit that now is online and available through Dementia Friendly America. And so states across the nation are replicating this Dementia Friendly community model using the toolkit. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel. The toolkit is quite accessible for every single sector. For example, there's a sector guide. So if you want to organize your libraries, there's a library guide, banks, bank guide.
You know, what inspired you to start thinking about this?
Right. So I'm a trained sociologist. I was teaching sociology at a small Catholic school in Dubuque, Iowa, and received a call from my folks back in the Boston area that my dad had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So I returned to teach back east so I could be close to them. And after journeying a decade with my folks as a care partner, supporting them, both of them ultimately lived with and passed with dementia, I pivoted. I took a gap year and then went into elder services and ultimately dementia. It is actually my first love. What I learned from that journey was what I call the crucible experience, how painful it is, but also it was an awakening. I awakened to the possibility of us communicating beyond just computer-like brains through touch, through music, through art, through pet therapy. And I realize that there's so much more that we can do. And I also realize that our current systems are so broken, but there is hope and possibility, and not in a Disney way, but in a very real and grounded way.
Can you, when you were saying connecting in a, not just in a computer-like way, can you explain a little bit more about, from your own just personal experience, what that means, like the opportunities for connection?
Sure, absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, increasingly our life is digitized and everything, our access to information and to one another requires that we can navigate logins, apps, passwords, which really locks out a lot of folks. I don't know about you, but I have a whole folder of passwords, for example. So
have a whole folder of passwords.
So we're losing our face-to-face connections in many regards. While I love technology, and the algorithms that help us navigate them, they're really a detriment to folks who have cognitive challenges, such as dementia. But there are opportunities now through evidence-based programming, meaning there's research behind the outcomes, the impact of these programs. For example, Time Slips is a wonderful storytelling program. Improv is increasingly used, where improv, no one is wrong. You can create a story together as a community. We have memory cafes. This is a model coming from the Netherlands that came from the Netherlands and are proliferating across the nation.
What are they?
Oh, they're wonderful. So these are community events for folks living with dementia, no diagnosis needed, and their care partners, including their immediate family and friends, where you share food in a normal environment, non-medicalized environment, non-stigmatized environment, and also activities. So in our hometown, we have the fourth Monday of every month at a restaurant where we have a gourmet pizza buffet and we have themed conversations. So we just had a trivia night of everything Irish this past month, and we had Irish music playing. And it's a place where we can have this face-to-face communication, non-mediated, you know, there's no login necessary. So folks can visit face-to-face, and a real sense of community is developing and a sense of intimacy between the folks living with dementia and their care communities.
Is there a moment that you've witnessed at one of these memory cafes that just sticks with you?
Yes. We had one family, multi-generational. So we had the grandchild, the mother, and then her parents. And the grandfather had dementia. And one week or 1 month, our theme was genealogy, and he had done a genealogy project when he was more oriented, and they brought it in. And given the space is a safe space, so we're patient for folks when they try to find their words. Anyway, he started telling stories and showing his chart, and his granddaughter started crying with joy because she said she hadn't seen her grandfather so engaged in a long, long time.
Wow. You know, I do understand that libraries are a big thing for you, as in a place where you do see an opportunity to try out some of these ideas so that people with dementia can have that experience of being out in the world and thriving somewhere. Can you talk about the role of libraries in what you're doing?
Absolutely. One of the things that I've seen in Massachusetts and across the country is that libraries are stepping up to be leads in these dementia-friendly community movements. A lot of libraries are places where folks can go and spend a good deal of time. So you see a lot of children, but also older individuals getting out of their homes, going to library places. They're safe, they're community places, they're vibrant. And so when library staff get trained to recognize the signs of dementia and also to start reaching out and supporting folks with dementia, it's really wonderful. So for example, one of the libraries in our area has a list and knows folks who are living with dementia, and they actually greet them at the door, and they have a list of their favorite types of books. So they have a more personalized experience in the library. But libraries are also increasingly meeting places for these cafes. Our library in Andover, we're thinking, may start a dementia dialogues. We're going to try it for a few months to have a place where people can come, again, safe, not stigmatized, not medicalized, and we can just share coffee and talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly, because there's so much stigma and so much negative narrative around dementia. And when we reframe it as living with a disability, just as we've reached out to children with autism, we can reach out to older folks with a disability as well. So the reframing is really important. The library is a vibrant place for that to happen.
April Roy of the Kansas City Public Library is with us now. She's been doing some of these things at the library here. And as part of that, she's really involved in a citywide effort to rethink Kansas City and dementia friendliness, who has access, who doesn't, and how that might change. Hi, April.
Hi there.
So talk to me about what you are doing at the library.
So we have a couple different programs happening at the Kansas City Public Library that have been going on for a couple of years now. We started our programming with a program that we call Movies and Memories, which is a dementia-friendly movie experience. Just as Emily was talking, so many people stop being able to do the things that they used to love to do. So we wanted to create a multi-sensory movie experience for people with dementia.
When you say multi-sensory, what do you mean?
We start the event with the smell of popcorn, just like you would have in a movie theater. We pop it fresh in a big machine. We try to add in lots of hands-on elements and some discussion elements.
But hands-on like what?
We did a Movies and Memories where we showed travel clips, and we had an interactive map where people could look at the map and put stickers on places they had been and then have conversation with the people around them about those places. We've done some hands-on mural making we did a food movie, and people talked about recipes and wrote their favorite recipes, and we talked about family times around food. We've done numerous themes for our Movies and Memories program.
Can I just jump in and say, mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that you are like actively encouraging people to access memories. Do you ever have someone who gets upset or frustrated that they can't access the memories that you're asking them about?
We've had that on occasion, but for the most part, the other people around are able to steer that conversation, or we move on to something different, or someone will say something that will spark something else, and we can steer that conversation in a different direction.
It's just interesting to me because in my experience interacting with people who are just very obviously suffering from dementia, my approach has always been to really be in the present moment with them. And it does intrigue me that you are taking a different approach.
We also take the approach to try to spark what might be there. That if you have a past memory about food that you shared with your family, then we try to spark that. if you don't, that's okay. Whatever thought you have is just fine. And it's such a safe and inviting space that people are comfortable with whatever idea they want to share.
Emily, jump in here.
Yeah, that's right. I really like what you started mentioning, you know, the sense of presence, presence mixed with accepting whatever comes forth. It could be a memory or it could be an association. Associations are oftentimes the case. And that's why, you know, improv, for example, is really wonderful. And same with time slips, these two different mechanisms.
Wait, what are time slips?
Yeah, time slips is an evidence-based program that started where you decide as a group on a photo, and then the group talks, you ask the group certain questions, and you develop a story together. And it's very emotional, sometimes hysterically funny, sometimes very powerfully sad. But, you know, you have a picture and you say, so what's happening in this picture? And everything is right. So that's the other piece to April's great work, is whatever someone says, and that's the improv ground rule, is everything is yes, that's right. There's no correction whether they got a memory right or not, or this story, you know, what's happening in this picture? What are the people doing? Who are these people? And people will say sometimes, that's my cousin, or, you know, or that's my dog. And it's a prompt to help people reminisce, I guess. And all memories are social constructs. They're all constructed. There's no accuracy anyway for any of us. So in these safe places, and I love, April, what you're talking about in terms of this movie night or day.
What does the smell of popcorn do?
Yeah. For me, and I think for most of our participants, it really sets the tone that I'm at this movie experience. You know, when you walk into a movie theater, that's the first thing that assaults you, is that delicious smell of that fresh popping popcorn. So we want them, you know, from the second they walk in the door, to know they're having a movie experience.
And not a library experience that exactly is supposed to be like a movie experience.
Exactly.
So how does what you're doing with these kinds of programs fit into a larger goal for Kansas City? What's the vision?
So what we're hoping to do in Kansas City, and we'll be starting with our great talk from Emily this Friday, is really target the different areas. We think that anyone that wants to be involved in making Kansas City more dementia-friendly should be able to be involved. So we're going to do a series of targeted lunch and learns for folks in all different areas of service in Kansas City, starting with our neighborhoods and neighborhood leaders, working with our faith communities, and then focusing some on libraries to really teach those organizations what they can do easily to make their neighborhood, faith community, or library more dementia-friendly.
And you've been doing some trainings with other organizations, right?
We have. We have a great group of partners involved that have given us a lot of really good information to use and to pass on to our community. We've done one lunch and learn that was very successful, where we talked about our programming. And then we've been going all over to talk about the great work that libraries could be doing in this area.
I am curious, though, when you're training other people, what are some of the like little things that you suggest that might seem small, but that make a big difference, like a subtle shift?
So much of it is just being dementia aware, being memory aware. It's what Emily was talking about before. If you see someone that looks disoriented, approaching them, asking if you can help, it's really that raising awareness that is our main goal. There are some other, you know, facility things that make a difference, big clocks and that kind of thing. But really, awareness is the key.
So, you know, when you think about Kansas City in particular, do you think that there are some Kansas City specific issues for people with dementia and Kansas City specific solutions?
I think that there are a lot of opportunities as Kansas City continues to grow and develop. There are a lot of great opportunities that if we are aware now, we can build them in as we grow and as Kansas City continues to develop. One example is our new airport. What if we had a dementia-friendly airport in Kansas City? There's not another dementia-friendly airport in the country. So we see that as a great opportunity to raise awareness now.
Are there other opportunities that you see, like future, like structural, infrastructural design, like policy changes that you would hope for?
I'm always thinking big, so I imagine great signage and comfortable spaces for people to be in, and mostly just an aware populace, neighbors that are aware and helpful and friendly.
What are the signs you would look for? I mean, if our listeners are maybe being trained right now.
I'm going to ask Emily if she'll speak on that one.
Yeah, at many of our meetings, we'll have folks living with dementia speak about some of the challenges they find, and some of the stories are amazing. So signage is that, I would just say the theme should be less is more. Some of the signages that restaurants, for example, think are cute, like one woman living with dementia said, you know, they had a mermaid on the woman's bathroom door and a pirate on the men's bathroom door, and she couldn't get the signifier. You know, what was it signifying? So, you know, she was saying, you know, less signage, clear signage would be really helpful. Also, simple spaces that reduce stimulation. So it's really quite the opposite of where our mainstream culture is going. You know, even our museums, we think that, you know, the hyper-stimulation with all the multimedia is really the direction we should move in a postmodern society and a highly technical, technological society. But actually, a lot of the research is showing that if we go back to more simple in displays, a lot of texture-based displays, tactile displays, also oral messaging so that folks don't have to rely on reading. A lot of people living with dementia lose the capacity to read. Also, restaurants can simplify their menus and also train staff. So in Massachusetts, this is a movement called the Purple Tables Movement, sorry. And you can make a reservation and get a trained waiter to come over and say, you know, today we have fish and we also have steak. What would you like? You know, to really simplify things because, you know, our multitasking, our, you know, computer-like brain actually is stressing not only folks living with dementia, we're finding, but more generally,
all
of us. So, you know, this notion, so that's the other thing that's really important to think about. When a community becomes dementia-friendly, it becomes more accessible for everyone. And one of the things that folks living with dementia are saying is that we have physical ramps for folks with physical disabilities, but we want cognitive ramps. So we can think in terms of our design and our signage and even, you know, our parks. What are the cognitive ramps that we need to help people know where a bench is, you know, where the restrooms are, you know? And so this is the point, to really simplify our life. And I think it brings down the stress for all of us.
You know, I am curious, as you've worked with various communities and studied what people do in other countries, how do you see differences in culture from city to city or country to country, or differences in infrastructure from one place to another affecting people with dementia differently? I mean, do you have the sense that some cities are already more dementia friendly than others?
I do. And it, you know, it comes from the history of the city. So, for example, Boston is a nightmare for all of us to even drive in. The roads are not grid-like, you know, as they are in the Midwest. So Boston is more difficult just because of its history. Here, I was already saying to April and others that how accessible, you know, your downtown is with the rail. That's free. You know, you can simply hop on and folks are so friendly. And then the grid-like system, you know, you already have this layout that makes it more accessible. I went to Singapore last year and I met with the dementia-friendly folks there. And of course, their Asian culture, without being overly stereotypical, has a certain way and a historically a respect for elders that already makes dementia-friendly a little bit easier. In the U.S., we have such ageism. You know, if you're over 25, you're old. And that really, you know, contributes to the stigma where people run away from dementia instead of running towards dementia.
And I was just thinking when you were talking about some of the things that we could adapt in our way of approaching people dealing with dementia. I mean, there's so much that we do adapt to make certain spaces friendly for children. Or for, you know, for various groups, but that some of that is grounded in this idea of their future potential or something like that. You know what I'm saying? And I wonder if that sort of deflates people's sense of purpose when it comes to addressing something like dementia.
It does. And one of my callings, I guess, the reason I do this work is to reframe dementia. If you talk with folks living with dementia, I was a director of two different social day programs. I can see that folks still learn, that we learn in different ways. That, and in fact, I have a dear friend who lives with Lewy bodies, and he's a national advocate. And he learned how to paint after he was diagnosed. So it's a reframing of this notion of potential. We already have a difficult challenge ahead of us because of our ageism. But when we live in the present, incredible things can happen. So in this social day program, I'll give you one example. This husband came in today to pick up his spouse who had been in the day program all day. And he said, "How was she today?" Because she had a bad night. And I said, "She was amazing. She sang all day." And he looked at me and said, "What? She doesn't sing." And I smiled and I gave him a hug. And I said, "She does now." So this is the notion. It's a reframing of human potential. People can learn to dance, to move. And one of the things that I see a lot is folks who have had to be hyper-responsible in their work lives. When they have dementia, they're allowed to be playful and to be more childlike, which we should all be able to laugh and play more. And here they are.
Emily Kearns, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And April Roy, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You can join the public conversation about how to become a more dementia-friendly city at the Plaza branch of the library this Friday at 11. There's a networking opportunity for organizations wanting to get involved starting at 10. Just before the program, there's more information at the library's website. Up next, the story of a guy who grows orchids in a cave and what the future holds after his business caught fire. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're going to meet a man with a passion for orchids. Horticulturist David Bird, owner of Bird's Botanicals, was growing orchids in a Missouri cave for years. A recent fire forced him out of the cave, and he's joining us now to talk about the fire and what the future holds, but also orchids and what it takes to grow them in this part of the country. David Bird, good morning.
Hi, Gina.
These flowers are beautiful. You brought in a couple.
I'll give you a little spring fever.
Yeah, for sure. I was sorry to hear about the fire. What happened?
Well, there was accumulation of a lot of trash on top of the cave that we really didn't know about. Obviously, the owner did.
The owner of the cave?
Yes. And it caught fire, and the smoke came in and damaged the plants.
And you announced back in January that you had said goodbye to the cave. That must have been hard.
It was. It actually, we started moving out actually in September when the smoke first came in, and we realized it wasn't too toxic for the plants to even stay there. So we kind of started moving out actually toward the end of September.
Wow. We will get back to the fire, and we'll talk some more about also what's next for you. But I do want to understand why you had set up shop in a cave in the first place. What do orchids need to thrive?
Well, the cave was just the ideal situation for the orchids because I could control everything that they needed. I could control the light and the humidity and the temperature. And so for the orchid, it was like, hey, this is the perfect thing. If they're blooming too slow, I could just put them in a warm room and then they would bloom quicker. And if they're blooming too fast, I could put them in a cool room and I could slow them down and then I'd have them just the way I wanted them when I needed them.
Forgive me, I have very little experience with caves and I also have very little experience with orchids. So I want to understand the cave piece of it. Why is it so easy to control everything in a cave?
Well, because I was in charge of it. I could add the light. I could give them
as opposed to like the weather being in charge.
As to a greenhouse. Yeah. Because mostly you'd have them in a greenhouse or in a window sill. And of course, in the winter, if it's cold and cloudy, well, the orchid just sits there until better days, until it gets a little bit warmer, and then it blooms when it wants to. Well, this winter, I had them in a greenhouse, and you know how cold it was. Well, my orchids, even with the sun coming out, the greenhouse didn't warm up. A lot of these orchids that I brought today should have bloomed at Valentine's Day.
Oh, well, so Talk to me about the moment when you did ditch the greenhouse for the cave. Can you take me back to this realization that, like, okay, here's what orchids need, and here's an environment that makes more sense in the Midwest?
Well, I was growing, actually, the plants in my greenhouse at home, and, it was just too small, and I needed more space, and I couldn't time them. So they'd all come into bloom at one time. And so that's when I was looking for some more space. And I thought, the greenhouse really isn't maybe the ideal situation. So I tried this cave idea. And my wife thought I was crazy. And I said,
It does have a certain crazy sound to it. What if I went to a cave? Like, under any circumstances, when you start a sentence that way, I think there's potential for someone to think that is crazy.
Right. That's for sure. And then when you would drive into the cave just to see us, and you know, it's kind of dark and it's kind of dingy. And then all of a sudden you open up this door and then there's this room full of thousands and thousands of plants.
It must have been amazing.
It was. And then it was also, you could smell them with the fragrances and the color. And you're like, wow, this is really kind of a neat situation.
I want to go there now. It must be very hard for you that this isn't any longer like your setup.
Yeah, it's been a real adjustment this winter. But, you know, I go to my greenhouse and think, well, it's not ideal, but the plants are still blooming and it is, you know, quite pretty.
How did you get into orchids in the first place?
I was a kid. I was 16 years old. My folks took me to Hawaii. I bought 5 plants. I came home and I was like, man, this is really cool. And before you knew it, I was just buying and collecting and reading and studying. And
can you take me to that trip where you're a 16-year-old who what he does on his family vacation to Hawaii is buy 5 plants?
Well, yeah, everybody was at the beach and I think I told them, I said, I'd like to try this orchid thing. Let me see if we can find one.
Do you remember what was going through your head, or it was just like instinct?
I think I was already kind of into plants. At the time, I think I was studying bugs. And then all of a sudden, I saw the plants, and I'm like, oh, this is really neat. And so I brought them home. I started collecting, getting more. By the time I got out of college, I had 700 plants.
Wow. Did you live in a castle?
No. I would just con somebody and give me a little space on a windowsill at first, and then finally, every time I had a job, I would just always bring, you know, 500 or 600 or 700 plants with me.
So you had your plants, like, dispersed in random places. You just took care of them all over the place.
At first, but then later on, wherever I would work, there was always greenhouse space, and I would try to have a little corner for my stuff.
Are you a native Midwesterner?
I'm from North Dakota.
North Dakota?
Yeah.
So tropical plants must have been quite an astonishing thing to see when you went to Hawaii.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was fascinated by everything, but I think it was the orchid that really grabbed me, and I'm like, I got to try this.
What do you remember what it was about the orchid? Can you describe? I mean, I think a lot of our listeners have seen orchids. Maybe some people can't quite picture it. Describe an orchid like you're describing it to someone who has never seen one, and you're trying to tell them not just what the plant looks like, but why it is so beautiful.
Well, we can use this one as an example. I mean, it's hard for your listeners to, but it's a white flower, and it's called a moth orchid or a Phalaenopsis, which is the most popular kind that most people have tried and maybe killed. And it looks like a group of moths that are flying. See it?
I do see
the little
it.
Moths?
Sort of in clusters of what would be wings on a moth, but petals on an orchid.
Yep. So that's why it's called a moth orchid. And this is the most popular one. And, you know, surprisingly, there's all kinds of colors. The white is the most popular.
Again, I mean, I am not only sort of not schooled in caves, I'm definitely a novice in the orchid world. So forgive me if this sounds silly, but to my eye, one thing that is special about an orchid is that the stem is kind of tentacle-like. There aren't a lot of little leaves coming off all up and down it. It's like there's this long, elegant stem, almost like the neck of a swan or something. And then there's this sudden flourishing of blossoms that is in some ways very simple. That's not like some kind of crazy poof of things, but that it is a real flourish that is very sort of sudden compared to this naked stem.
Right. It's called a spike. And the leaves are broad and they're kind of flat and they're at the bottom. And then the spike comes up. And, of course, we use a stick or a wire to support it. Otherwise, it would flop over, which in nature they would flop over, which is normal. But if it's in your home, you don't want it flopped all over your counter. So you would have the spike and then you have all the flowers on top. And there's about almost a dozen on each one of those spikes. And so this is a really nice little plant, and I even brought you a coffee cup.
Aw, is the orchid especially delicate?
The flowers are very, very delicate. The plants are actually pretty durable.
The plants themselves.
Yeah.
People get them because of the flower.
Oh, yeah. It's very elegant, stately, and they last a long time.
If you don't kill them.
If you don't put ice cubes on them.
So, yeah, talk to me about this. Everybody seems to have like a trick for keeping orchids alive, and I overheard the ice cube thing being expressed in my office earlier this morning. I've never heard that one before. I've heard a lot of tricks about spritzing with a little spray bottle and how often you're supposed to do that, but I'm guessing people have a lot of tricks because they are hard to keep alive.
What they've tried to do is simplify it, and so when you buy an orchid at a grocery store, they'll tell you to put 3 ice cubes on it so you don't overwater it. Well, like this is a good example. There's another pot inside this pot because this pot or the coffee cup doesn't drain, but there's another pot in there that would drain. Well, they told you to put the ice cube on it so you don't overwater it. Well, if the plant's nearly dry, I would take it out of this cup, take it to my sink, get the water kind of warm, and then I'd really soak it good, make sure that the plant's thoroughly watered, and then I would mix up a little fertilizer in a watering can. I use like an orchid food, and I put about a half a pint to a pint of fertilizer water on it. Now I've watered it, I've fertilized it, I let it drain, and then I can put it back in my cup. And then now the plant's got everything it needs for about a week.
So it's not that you should do something sort of particular like an ice cube to water it in the first place. It's that you have to know how often to do it, etc.
The best way is just use your finger and check to see if the media is dry, or pick it up. If you can tell that the container is dry, you can tell because the plant is lightweight.
Can I tell you, I am curious about just the orchid and its level of actual sensitivity, though, because from all of these tips and tricks that people have to just the general track record of killing them, and also like, there's a song I happen to like that has a lyric in it that's, you can't study orchids with a bulldozer. And
I've never heard that one.
As though the orchid is this symbol of this sort of untouchable, perfect thing that if you get in there and mess with it, you're going to screw it up. Is that what this plant is to you?
Oh, no, they're not. They're easy. The plant's like 7 years old before it blooms, so it's got to be able to put through a lot of harsh conditions. The only couple things is don't freeze it, don't cook it, and don't put it outside in full sun when it's been inside under shady conditions.
But so what do you do as a horticulturist? And we'll do this imagining that you're still in the cave setting first. What do you do to grow an orchid from seed? What is your role in this as the horticulturist?
If I was to grow them from seed, which I have, basically I've made a hybrid and I cross-pollinate it. And when I got a seed pod 3 to 4 months later, I send it to a laboratory for 3 to 4 years. And then they call me when my plants are ready and they send them back. And then I plant them out. And then 4 more years, I'll have flowers.
Wow. That's a long incubation.
That's a long process, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
And I seem to remember we have talked before something involving like gloves and pollination and.
Oh, to pollinate the flower?
Yeah.
Oh, toothpick.
Toothpick.
That was all it took. It's just a toothpick.
Tell me about pollinating flowers with a toothpick.
Well, you just take the pollen and you put it on the stigmatic surface of the other one, and then it develops a pod. And then in 3 to 4 months, you have seeds, and then there's like dust. And then you send it to the lab and they grow them in a test tube.
That's so wild. So growing orchids in the Midwest, that is not a totally intuitive thing to do. How do you overcome, like, what are the challenges of growing orchids in the Midwest and how do you overcome those?
Well, with the greenhouse, it is a challenge because our winters are cold and cloudy and our summers are hot and sunny.
So the challenge is that we are not tropical.
Right. So the best thing to do for most people is buy an orchid in bloom, put it in your east window.
But how do you overcome them? You're growing tons of orchids. Like, how do you personally overcome this? The cave.
Well, without the cave, I have to take the greenhouse and I have to provide more shade. Because first of all, I was burning them this winter. Then I would check their watering, make sure that they always got watered about once a week. And then a little bit of fertilizer. And then you just kind of watch them and wait.
David Bird of Bird's Botanicals, hang on with me for just a minute, okay?
Okay.
After the break, we'll hear more about the fire that forced Bird's Botanicals out of the Missouri cave where they've operated for years, and we'll find out what's next for this orchid operation. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Don't go away. We're back. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and our guest is horticulturist David Bird of Bird's Botanicals. He's known for growing orchids in a Missouri cave, but after a fire, he's had to leave the cave that's been his horticultural home and kind of his coup. He's had to leave that behind. And David, hello again.
Hello.
So as we have sort of explained already, a cave cannot burn down. You've had to leave the cave because of a fire that happened outside of it.
That's correct. To start with, the owner was burning trash on top of the cave and the smoke came in and damaged the plants. And it was so toxic that they literally react like a canary in a coal mine, where the pollutants are so bad that, you know, would kill the canary. Well, the orchid is very sensitive to any type of smoke or toxic chemicals, and the flowers literally started to fold up the very day that they got it.
That sounds so sad, like to see like these sort of withering tropical flowers.
It was, because it happened so fast. Usually about 3 days they would react, but it was so toxic that they just folded right up.
Is finding a new cave a preposterous idea? I know nothing about cave real estate.
I'm done with caves.
You're done with caves?
Yeah.
I'm surprised, because I feel like this is kind of your big coup. I mean, I don't think growing orchids in caves is that a general thing. It's a special thing you were doing.
It was. It was a very unique situation. We were becoming a tourist attraction. We had a lot of folks from out of town and in town would come visit us. We were like one of the top 10 hidden secrets of Kansas City and places to go and see really cool plants and bloom.
Yeah, there was some national coverage of this phenomenon.
The
Missouri cave where orchids are in bloom.
Yep, we had a lot of good PR and a lot of good press. And we had more and more people coming to visit us all the time. So it was really getting to be pretty overwhelming, actually, because so many people were coming to visit us.
It's hard for me to believe that you don't want to be in a cave again after finding this special niche.
I think because the watching your plants die is the worst thing, you know, you could possibly have to deal with after 16 years of watching these things grow and flourish and bloom and then be able to sell them. It was really, you know, something. But I think my daughter helps me in the business, and it was probably more than both of us could ever deal with again. So we decided that we're just going to, you know, learn how to grow the plants in a greenhouse.
Is burning trash on top of caves a common enough thing that is something you would be in danger of experiencing again? Or is the cave setting maybe just too traumatic to return to now?
Well, I think this is kind of like notorious for just this owner of the cave. But I think other caves are probably better well operated and maintained. I think for us, I think it's just too traumatic for us to see what happened. And it's too big an undertaking to have to rent the space and hook up the equipment and have the lighting and the benches and the whole thing again. It's like, it's just more than we can deal with. We're just going to try to do it with the greenhouse.
So how has that been going? Tell me about the greenhouse experience.
Well, I have a small one in my house, and we've been operating kind of out of there, mostly getting plants ready for, we supply the florists in town, and we have some leases. And then, of course, our greenhouse south of town, we're getting that ready for the plants that I'll start with City Market this weekend, hopefully. I want to start at City Market, and then eventually Overland Park on weekends, too.
So you have kind of a network of greenhouses, and you're doing a circuit of farmers markets, it sounds like.
Yep, that's going to be kind of our goal for the spring and summer, is to, especially City Market for this Saturday, and then hopefully in a few weeks we'll start on Sundays. And then we bring the orchids down there, and people can find us and see the plants, or they can bring their own plants down if they need diagnosis. Because without the cave, a lot of people are going, what do I do? I don't have anybody to look at my plant and tell me what I'm doing wrong or supply me with bark.
So you do some plant doctoring?
Oh, yeah. We did a lot of plant doctoring.
Tell me about that. What kinds of things do people bring their orchids in for? And what are the kinds of remedies you're able to provide?
Usually they'll come in and the leaves are soft and withery. And that's because they've probably overwatered it in most cases. Sometimes the flowers would fall off on a plant that they bought, and usually not ours because we usually will tell them what to do. And all of a sudden, the flowers all fell off at once, and that's usually because it got too hot or too cold really fast. And we've seen that happen a lot. A lot of cases, the roots are growing all over the pot, and it needs to be repotted. And so we had a service that we would provide. For like $5, we'd repot their plant. Well, we probably had to give that up now because we don't have that same situation where people can bring it in and we can doctor it up for them. We'll just give them the diagnosis.
But you do consultations.
What's that?
You do just brief consultations as opposed to like inpatient care.
Right. We were doing like full diagnosis of the problem, but we weren't really the hospital.
Yeah.
We didn't take them in and say, well, we'll call you when it's all healthy again. It was up to them to follow the directions to save the plant.
So, but you are still going to offer that the basic diagnosis piece of it at the various farmers markets?
Yeah, they can always bring their plant down. And they used to, in the past, they'd bring their plant down. And usually we could say, well, you need to fertilize it more or you need to repot it. And that's the most common things is no fertilization. And the media was over, you know, 2 or 3 years from being repotted. So the plant would be stressed out.
I can relate. It is amazing that people love their orchids in this way, that they will, you know, pack them up, take them on the road, bring them to you to take care of them and help them get better and help them flourish. I know I kind of keep coming back to this, but what do you think it is about orchids that makes people try to figure out how to make the Midwest habitable for this tropical plant that makes people willing to come to you for plant doctor consultations? You know what I mean?
It's the challenge. And also they want to see it bloom with their own experience. If they buy it and bloom and they enjoy it, but then it's when they bloom it themselves, now all of a sudden they really feel like they have a sense of accomplishment. And now that plant has become part of their family, and they might have it for years and years, and they want it to flourish, and they want it to bloom. And so they really get some satisfaction that they think they took a hard plant to really grow. And if they're successful, they're like, well, I want to get more now.
Is that the same for you?
Well, it was at one time, but, you know, I had 10,000 plants. I don't know if I'll ever get to that level again.
Is there one thing that you have enjoyed about moving your operation to the greenhouse, or it's still a little sad for you?
The greenhouse has given some of the plants that didn't bloom as well as I always hoped because it was never enough light. And now all of a sudden I'm seeing plants that I've had for years are starting to produce flowers that I haven't seen in years.
Well, that's exciting.
It is. It is. And some of them are growing better and faster than they used to. But it's fun to see things that you haven't seen bloom for a long time start to do well.
David Bird of Bird's Botanicals, thank you so much and good luck bouncing back.
Thank you.
That is a wrap for today's show. You can grab both of the conversations we had this morning at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the story of 3.2 beer in Kansas. It's the end of an era as Kansas overturns age-old restrictions preventing the sale of full alcohol beer in grocery stores and convenience stores. That conversation about near beer on KCUR's Central Standard. The show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.